Welcome back to episode 12 of The Synopsis. Obviously, I am Zach, and I may or may not be joined by a guest today. I'm not sure yet. We'll find out later on. But before we get started today, before we get into this time online and all that good stuff and our stories and everything else, quick shout out to Tim, our first subscriber slash sponsor. If you want to sponsor us, you can do that on the anchor.fm app or online. anchor.fm is as cheap as 99 cents per month, and it will help us get some new equipment, some new audio, maybe some better quality. But shout out to Mr. Tim. He came up with the idea of today's topic. We'll talk a little bit more about my culinary school and all that good stuff, maybe some stories or whatever. We'll see where the podcast goes. We kind of just do our thing here. You know how we do it. We just kind of ramble on until shit comes together and it makes enough time for people to listen to. So without further ado, let's get on to this time online. And we have a lot to talk about online stuff today, especially with a lot of things that happened yesterday. So let's get into it. Alright, so let's get right into it. Obviously, the first things we're going to talk about is the massive shootings that happened in El Paso and in Dayton today, basically back to back. I believe it was over 20 people killed in El Paso from a Walmart. I think it was a Walmart or something that they were shot in. The guy came out saying that he was a supporter of Making America Great Again, all this shit, and basically was a terrorist. And that's what a lot of people around the news didn't call it, a terrorist attack or anything like that. They just kind of discussed it as a man who went in there with issues or something like that. They were wondering why he did it, even though, like, he had Trump on his gun. He was stating that he needed to get rid of the Mexicans. His words, not mine, so don't get it twisted. And we're not going to talk about, like, a politics or any shit like that. We're just going to talk about the facts here. The fact is, the guy went in there and he shot 20 plus people, and a lot of these people were afraid to go to medical facilities out of fear of ICE trying to capture them and deport them, why they were injured or why they needed medical services. A lot of them were obviously of a Hispanic descent, which is why this guy went to this store and decided to shoot them because of that. Again, not getting into politics or anything like that, but the biggest thing on the news media outlets is that they blamed this shooting on video games. And I don't know about you guys listening, but for me, this has been a thing for years and years and years and years. We've had video games. We discussed this in another podcast about video games being blamed for murders and mass shootings and all that stuff. We go back to Mortal Kombat. We go back to the Doom scenario where the two kids shot the school because their school basically was the same map layout as what Doom was. So there has been stuff in the past that can be linked to video games. However, the violence here, the needless violence, let's be honest, is not influenced by games. This was one man's motive to try and, in his words again, eradicate the problem of what America had. And yet again, I'm going to state it out there because I don't want people getting it misinterpreted. This isn't a politic rant, this isn't anything like that, but something needs to happen with the gun laws in the States, either better control or something like that. A lot of people are up in arms about this, especially after the Dayton shooting that happened the day after this one that happened in El Paso. So then, Neil deGrasse Tyson, the famous scientist, said, "In the past 48 hours in the USA, horrifically lost 34 people from mass shootings. On average, across 48 hours, we also lose 500 people to medical errors, 300 to the flu, 250 to suicide, 200 to car accidents, and 40 to homicides via handgun." So, with that tweet, he pissed off a lot of people, obviously, because people are saying, well, mass shootings has nothing to do. Medical errors are exactly that, errors. The flu is a sickness. Suicide is because of the fact of depression isn't really being treated as an illness here. And not just in America, around the world, it is very stigma is the word I think I should use best there. It's a stigma for male people to get help when they're having depression or suicidal thoughts. It's more of a suck it up, Sally, and deal with it kind of mentality that is given across the world. If a man comes out with depression or a mental illness, it's typically like, oh, you're just being a little bitch about it, deal with it. Hence why male suicide rates are up. We go back to the Etika story about how he killed himself because he was afraid to reach out. So don't be afraid to reach out. Car accidents, again, another accident thing. And 40 homicide via handgun. Now, this is something that a lot of people were pointing out on Twitter, that if you're going to talk about gun violence and talking about how many people died in a mass shooting, why are you even mentioning homicide with handguns? You kind of proved the point that something needs to be done based on that statement that you just made. You just said handguns are involved in homicides, which means if the mass shooting happened, obviously something involving guns, then something needs to be changed. Australia did something with their gun laws. They haven't had a shooting since 94, I believe. The UK did some things. Germany, Berlin is in Germany. No shit, Sherlock. Brussels was the word I was looking for, not Berlin, sorry. Sweden, Denmark, all those European places, like a lot of a karma kind of thing. And it comes back to the Americans, like the right to bear arms and all this stuff, and the right-wing Republicans and Democrats. It doesn't matter at the end of the day who you vote for or what you believe in. Everyone has to come to an agreement that something is wrong right now in the States with guns and with violence. So with that being said, Trump himself went out and tweeted something about lowering the flags at half-mast in respect for the victims. But here's the thing. We've had over 250 mass shootings in America this year. That's more shootings than there has been in days of the year. And you don't see them being lowered every 5 seconds, the flags and whatnot. So it's definitely something that needs to be done to help combat the violence and everything that's happening right now. We're losing pointless lives, and it's something that we shouldn't be doing in this day and age. We're 2019 now. I know everyone's like, oh, we're in 2019, everything should be equal, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, we're losing lives every single day due to unnecessary violence, and it's something that we need to change. Moving on from that subject, let's try and lighten up the mood before we get into the main gist of the podcast. We are going to talk about avocados. That's right, avocados, you know, the fruit slash vegetable. Technically, I believe it's a fruit because it has a pit or a seed. I don't know, maybe I'll look that up. Maybe you don't care. Honestly, I don't care either. Let's talk about avocados. Avocados had a big problem recently coming in from Mexico. The cartel decided to stop production of avocados and stop them from being transferred overseas to make them more money. And it's something that happens every single year. The Mexican borders are controlled by the cartel. And what happens is avocados go into seasoning and everything looks good. And then the cartel are like, oh, we can make a shit ton of money off of this, which they do. They make an extortionate amount of money. Extraordinary amount from avocados. So they'll be nice and ripe. The Mexican cartel will be like, listen, you need to pay us like $200,000 to get this over the border, otherwise you're not doing it. It halts production, it halts status, it kind of screws everything over, especially in my industry and like the grocery stores. If you go to your Aldi, your Walmart, Schnucks, Dearbugs, whatever it may be, you may notice all your avocados are bright green, hard as a rock, and just aren't usable. And that is because most of them are coming from Peru, Argentina, Brazil, kind of those South American borders and regions. Apart from Mexico, because they are the ones that have the best climate for these growths. That's why olive oil only comes from Italy, because it has a perfect climate, a perfect area for olive oil to be produced perfectly. Other places cannot reproduce olive oil. And the city in Italy, I can't remember what it's called, produces like 500 gallons of olive oil per day because they have the perfect climate. Same way with the avocados in Mexico. Perfect climate, the cartel stops it for a while. They eventually get their money and they move on. So avocados should be coming back into your restaurants, your stores, everything like that. They should be coming in ripe again. Same with mangoes. Mangoes are another one that are very, very difficult to get if certain places are not producing them or sending them through the border. So with the discussion of food, let's get into a little bit of culinary school experience and conversation about that, what I learned and what I didn't learn, and more especially what you can take away from my experience, my extortionate amount of money that I put into it, and what you can take from it for me to help you. So stay tuned after this commercial break. We're going to get into it, and then at the end of this podcast we're going to have a little cliffhanger teaser kind of vibe about what we're going to have next podcast, which should be a good one, and I hope you guys stay tuned and listen to all of that. Alright, so let's talk about culinary school. First thing is first, let me put it very clear out there. Do not go. Do not waste your money. It is a waste of money. Do not do it. For the love of God, unless you are literally trying to find something else to do in life, and you are beyond all options, do not go to culinary school. Now, the reason I say that is, number one, when I went to culinary school, it cost me over $30,000, okay? Now, we're not going to hold back any punches here. We're going to talk about pricing. We're going to talk about what you learn and all that kind of mishmash of school. Culinary school is about 2 years. A year if you're going for a certification, and 2 years if you're going for a degree. I went for a degree. Now, the reason I went for the degree is as following. I was stuck in a job at the time where you needed a degree to progress in life, and I was at the point where I was like, well, I'm not going to be able to go back to school because I'm not going to be able to do another 4 years. I hated school when I was a kid. I still hate school. I hated culinary school. I hated everything about learning. And it's not like, oh, I hate learning. Learning's for suckers and shit like that. It's more of a case of when you're in school, I hate learning with books. I hate learning with text. I'm a learner by doing stuff or visually doing it, if that makes sense. So you show me how to do it and then I will do it back, and if it works, hey, perfect. If not, I'm not going to go through a textbook and try and figure that shit out. It's not for me. So during culinary school, I had to take gen ed classes and all that good stuff. These consisted of like math, English, basic communication and stuff like that. So it was kind of good to understand how to learn how to plan a business and learn how to communicate with people, like customers, your staff and all that stuff. But realistically, I'm learning things that I already knew or that aren't going to help me in the long run. Now, don't get me wrong, it's good to learn X and Y and all that stuff in mathematics, because then that way you can figure out your food costs, your prepping, your planning, your ounceage, all that good shit. But I don't need to learn how to use proper English. Like, I don't care. If you work in the restaurant industry, you know 9 times out of 10, you're not going to be using English, you're going to be using Spanish or Japanese, because that's the main two of what the languages are in the kitchen. My kitchen is predominantly Spanish, so I know basic Spanglish, so to speak, but I'm not going to use correct, proper English because, one, when you talk like that, you sound like a fucking prick. And number two is that when you're writing up a menu or anything, that's what you got Word for and spell check and all that shit. So it's all good. You don't need to learn English. So I got a little bit off topic. Hey, that's what we do here. We ramble, we go on tangents. It's all good. So back to the culinary school. Like I said, dead end job, needed a degree to move up, blah, 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 whatever. So we decided culinary school is the way to go. I heard a commercial on TV one day or the radio, something like that. And I was like, you know what? That sounds like a vibe. Let's go do the thing. Went to the school, signed up, just went there to actually look around and everything. Next thing I know, I signed up for school. I came home to my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time. And I was like, yo, I'm going to culinary school. And she was like, bitch, what? Why would you do that? And I was like, well, I'm dumb as a motherfucker and I need something to pretend that I'm smart. And she was like, oh yeah, that makes sense, you know, you are a dumbass and shit like that. So it was all good. So I went to culinary school, I started, and we started with P1. There was P1, P2, P3, and they were like your basic three stages of classes. Now, my classes were 6 weeks long, and they consisted of 4-hour classes Monday through Friday. You obviously had the weekends off, and like I said in the previous podcast, actually the last podcast, it's a pain in the ass when people come into school like, oh yay, we made this at home last night because we did it. Well, when you're working in the industry and you're going to school for it and all that stuff, you get tired, you get burnt out quickly, you don't want to deal with it. So we did have three basic classes to start with. Class one was learning your basic sources, your mother sources, your BEFV. So BEFV is your five mother sources, your bechamel, your espanol, your tomato, your hollandaise, and your velouté. That's your BEFV. So if you're going to take anything away from this podcast, your five mother sources are your BEFV. You also have other ways to remember things like fat tom, which is your food acidity, time, temperature, oxygen and moisture, and like how to cook steaks and stuff like that. So another thing I learned was fat tom. You also learned the basic thing of the temperature danger zone, you know, 40 to 135. All that kind of stuff is drilled into you, the basics of culinary. And obviously your basic knife skills, how to handle a knife, how to start the basic things. You didn't actually learn how to break down chicken or cow or fish or lamb. We had deer at once as well. You didn't learn how to break any of that down until further on when you had the fundamental knife skills. Your basic three classes that I'm talking about were to see if you were good enough, essentially. And not like good enough to be like, oh, run your own restaurant and stuff like that, just good enough to handle a knife and to be able to use it safely and correctly, use the equipment properly, so in that way they can continue teaching you. If you failed those first three classes, or you failed one of those three classes, this wasn't the industry for you, this wasn't the job for you. You should probably go home, sit down, drink a beer, and figure out what the fuck you're going to do with the rest of your life. Because if you can't figure out culinary, then something's wrong with you. Simple as that. Now, the reason I say about culinary school being a waste of time is the following. Everything I learned in school, I could have learned in the industry myself while I was on the job. Culinary school doesn't teach you the fast-paced environment of what the real industry is like. Now, for example, a practical test would be a 4-hour time slot in which you would make a starter, an entree, and a dessert. Now, a lot of these kids who I was working with or doing classes with would do it like that. They'd be like, okay, let me make a starter. Let me make a basic niçoise salad. So let me make my Dijon balsamic vinaigrette. Let me hand make it, because back then, you know, you'd have to whisk the oil in and all that stuff. They didn't teach you the little tips and tricks, like, for example, using an immersion blender or something like that to quickly get the dressing done. They would have you do it by hand and all that shit, like the traditional classical French techniques. So they would make the dressing, then they would cut their tomatoes, and they would cut their olives, and then their egg, and then their capers, and then they'd cut their fish, and then they'd cook their fish, and then they'd put it on the salad, and then they would make their starter, and that would take them about 45 minutes. Then they would do their entree, and they would do whatever their entree would be, and that would take them like another 2 hours, and then they'd move on to their dessert. And by that time, everyone is like, okay, we've got like 45 minutes left, and I've only just put my dessert in, I'm going to struggle to make time. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there with my hands just chilling on my ass, basically, because I've already been done for 2 hours. And everyone was always like, well, how do you get done so fast? What's your secret? What do you do? Mise en place. It's the easiest thing to do. Mise en place everything. If you're cooking at home, if you're cooking at a restaurant, mise en place. Prepare your shit before you cook it. Clean as you go. It makes life so much easier instead of having a stack of dishes at the end of everything or trying to do things step by step. If you know you have a dessert that's going to take an hour to make, then maybe you should, I don't know, prep the dessert and start cooking it while you start your appetizer. Simple as that. If you're making a salad or something, it doesn't take you that long if you know your tricks of your trade. You don't learn this stuff in culinary school because they're just like, okay, here's 4 hours, get your shit done. That's stuff you learn in the industry. They're not going to teach you, hey, okay, how to time manage in the middle of a busy lunch rush where you have 100 people coming in and you have to knock out 20, 30 things at a time. Because they can't do that. If they were in the culinary school, chances are you don't have 200-300 people there. You only have like 50 to 100 people per class or per at a time. So when they do the events like a banquet buffet and you make all this food for people and they have people come in. And for people like me especially, it was difficult working a 6 a.m. class. There's not many people going to school at 6 a.m. We had about 10 in our class and 20 people in the whole damn school at one time. So when we was doing buffets and banquets and shit like that, all that happened is you're making enough food for that many people and nothing else is really going to happen because you're not going to get that big rush, that big time, any shit like that. So learning that stuff in school, it was good. Don't get me wrong, to learn the fundamentals. However, when you're actually in a restaurant, you're going to pick up more tricks and tips than you are going to school. Like I said, school teaches you the fundamentals, the correct way to do things, the slow way to do things, not the efficient way. Now, don't get it wrong. The way you do things in a restaurant is going to be correct, but it's also going to be efficient. Like I said, you don't have that luxury at school. The luxury is just doing what you're told to do in the allotted time frame. A restaurant doesn't work like that. A restaurant is, okay, go, 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 stop, you have a little bit of time to prep, and you go again, bap, 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 bap. That's how it works in the industry. So that's what you got to get used to. So going to a culinary school will help you learn the fundamentals, but nothing more. So my advice would be, if you're thinking about going to culinary school, or you're thinking you're going to learn a lot from it, don't think about it, just don't do it. Just go work in the restaurant industry. It may help you get your foot in the door, but you don't want to be spending $36,000 or $38,000 or however it may be without grants and scholarships and all that stuff. You don't want to be spending that much money to learn something that someone like me, and let's be honest, I'm not exactly a teacher or anything smart, but I could teach you everything I learned in culinary school and I could charge you half the price and teach you a lot more because of what I've learned working my job over the years. And that's not knocking schools or anything like that. I think it's important for people to learn the fundamentals, to learn the basics, to learn how to make their sauces, to learn how to do all their prep and shit. But at the same time, if people want to learn, then they can go to the actual experience. And like anything, you're going to learn by doing. So school will help you learn the basics, but not learn by doing. The only good thing I can preach about the school was that you learn how to do business. And business would be like how to run your restaurant, how to figure out the costing and all that stuff. Now, to figure out food costs, it's a lot more difficult, and that's what school is for. The same with figuring out how to do labor, how to do budgeting, how to do food trucks, stuff like that. I could tell you how to open a food truck right now, and actually, you know what? I will tell you. You've got to rent out a place that has a health and safety standard code, that has room. You rent out a room in a restaurant, basically, you prep all your food, you keep it there so it's nice and cool, and then you will bring it onto your truck, make sure your truck's at a good temperature, get permits for it, get making sure that you have a health and safety code and everything like that, that there's no contamination, and then you can sell on a food truck. But a lot of people don't know about that. They just think it's as simple as, let me grab a truck, throw some food in there, throw some coolers or something in there, and away I go. It's not that simple, it never will be. A lot of practice and a lot of business go into that. To open your own food truck, you're looking at about $120,000 startup. And that's not me being like, oh, that's like the underside of it. And typically, you may be looking at $150,000, $160,000. The reason that is like I said, you got to rent out space. So you're renting out space per month from a restaurant. So what's that going to cost you? $500? How much is a truck going to cost you? About $20,000. And that's just a normal truck. Now you got to think about adding in a fryer potentially, or adding in a freezer, adding in something to keep your goods cool. You can't have a truck that has food that's raw over 40 degrees because it's not safe. You're going to kill somebody. You're going to give them food poisoning. It's not going to work. So you're looking at a high price budget. So that's something that I wouldn't have known unless I went to school. But now that's me passing on the knowledge that I learned to somebody else, which now means somebody else doesn't have to necessarily go to school to learn that stuff because I can teach them that myself. Same with budgeting, same with opening your own restaurant, okay, or catering. Catering's another one that people think is so easy to do, but it costs a lot of money if you're doing it as a professional job. So let's talk about catering. Catering is one of those things where you're paying by the each. So you're paying per silverware, you're paying per plate, you're paying per food. What you are paying as well is you're paying like linens, you're paying tables, you're paying chairs. A lot of people don't think about that. If you have a restaurant, you're already taking that into consideration. When you're doing catering, you're going to charge people per table, per chair, per linen, per silverware. All of that goes into your overall total cost. So when you take that total cost, you add it to what your food cost would be. You have to divide that number by people. And then you're going to get a good idea of how much you're going to try and charge people per plate to make sure you make a profit. There's no good having great food, great service, but then you're not making a profit or you're just barely breaking even. That's not how good business works. Good business works on making a profit. And that's why restaurants price things so high. You have these Michelin star restaurants that are selling you $200 plates and it's 7-course meal or something like that. When each meal comes out, you get like 2 leaves on a plate and some sauce or something like that. That's maybe a little exaggeration, but you look at Michelin star restaurants, they give you 7 to 10 courses. They're all little courses. They're making a lot of money on that because you're paying for the experience. You're paying for the experience of having the chef bring out the food or the server tell you what it is. But when you look at the portion size and do the math, you divide 10 by $200, you're going to get 20. So you're paying $20 a plate. And what are you getting on that plate? Is that plate worth $20? If you're getting 3 shrimp, and shrimp is priced right now at like $300 for 50 pounds, $300 for 50 pounds, divide that by 5, let's say $50 per pound, they're charging you $5 a shrimp, $6 a shrimp, basically. So when you do the math on that, is shrimp, you can buy, go to a grocery store and buy a pound of shrimp for $16. But you're paying $5 per shrimp at a Michelin star restaurant and you're getting 3 shrimp. That's where a lot of people make their money from. Now you got to think about it like that. It's smart business. So if you're opening your own restaurant, what's going to be the smartest thing for you to do? Me personally, if I was to open my own restaurant right now, I'd open a vegan restaurant. Obviously, it would promote veganism and it would help your lifestyle like mine. I'm not going to preach veganism and all of that crap, don't worry, but listen. If I'm making a panini, for example, I have this panini recipe that I have, a vegan sandwich, it's fantastic. Maybe I'll give you all the recipe. It's basically a red bell pepper jam. There's some pickled cucumbers on there, nice and spicy. There's some pico on there. There's a lot of flavors going on, but it's delicious. Trust me, it's fantastic. When you break it down, it costs about $6 to make overall, if you include bread and fries and all that stuff. $6. If I'm charging you $14.95, I'm making a 15% food profit on that. Every restaurant's goal should be at least a 20% food profit. So if you're under 20%, you're doing good. If you're over, you're going to be losing money. So if I'm making vegan food, vegan style restaurant, I'm going to be making a lot of money on that because I'm using fresh ingredients. I'm not using meat. The biggest thing that costs money in the restaurant industry is stuff like pork, chicken, beef, shrimp, salmon, or pastas. There's a lot of pastas that cost money. And not like because pasta's expensive, because don't get it wrong, pasta is cheap as all hell when you go to a restaurant or anything, but pasta is one of those things where it's a costly expense for a small portion of your menu. Now, you can make a big profit off of it, but if I was opening a vegan restaurant, I wouldn't do that. A vegan restaurant would basically be sandwiches, salads, and a rarity of an entree, like a couple of entrees, but nothing major. That would make a good profit, a good money maker, and like I said, even when you do that though, when you do the food costing, if you're running your own business, you got to think about the equipment. You got to think about, are you going to rent equipment or buy the equipment? If you rent the equipment, it costs more long term, but every time it needs to be fixed, the company will come and fix it. If you buy it, it costs more short term, but in the long run, if something breaks down, you don't have that covered. You have to pay somebody else to come out and fix it and then pay them. If you rent it, the company fixes it for you. Same with tables, same with linens. Your staff, how are you going to pay your staff? Are you going to pay your staff bi-weekly, weekly, monthly? Are they going to get wages? If they're serving, how much are you going to pay them? Your cooks, are you going to pay them? Are you going to run it yourself? There's so many variables in the industry that you need to take into consideration. So these are just a couple of things that you have to think about if you're thinking about opening your own business or thinking about going to culinary school. Like I said, I wouldn't pay the money again. Did I like the experience? Yes. Did I learn things? Yes. But was it worth that much money? Absolutely not. Especially when you're only paying for a 2-year course. Most colleges are 4 years. You're paying $10,000 a semester or whatever it may be. I paid nearly $40,000 to go to a 2-year schooling at 6 a.m. every day until 10 a.m. It was a stressful time, don't get me wrong. And it was very, very, like I said, very stressful, very expensive. I don't think it's worth the money. And that's just my personal opinion. At the same time, though, on the flip side, I wouldn't know what I know if I didn't go to school. But I could also save somebody else money by telling them my experience, telling them what I learned, and then that way I'm saving somebody else from making the same kind of mistake that I made, which was using that money, putting it into something that's not really returning the favor right now. I put a lot of money in, and any job, any college, anything like that. Yes, it's good to have a degree, but check it. You put so much money into getting a degree, going to college, whatever it may be. You have to get a return. So if you haven't got a good job after that, it's going to be a long time until you get that money back, that return that of that initial investment. It's a lot like the stock market. If you put $10 down on a stock and it drops to $8 a share, you've lost $2. You've got to wait till it goes back up, until the price rises, till the stock has more value, so then you can sell it. Same with going to school, going to college. You're putting down that initial investment knowing that your stock, you're the stock. Your stock is going to drop until it eventually rises. So as long as you can get through that initial hurdle of making that less money, making that minimum wage or whatever it may be, then you can start thinking about the rest of your career, whether it be in the restaurant industry or taxes or financial advisor, whatever it may be. You have to get over that initial introduction into the world. You can't go into the workforce expecting everything to be handed to you, because it's not like that. People are paid based off experience, and I know it's difficult to get experience, but at the same time, you have to work for that experience. You can't go into a job and being like, hey, I deserve this much money because I went to school for it. Okay, well, old Joe over here has been working in this industry for 40 years, He didn't go to school, but he's going to make double the amount of money you are because he knows what he's doing and he's proven himself time and time again. You have to pay your dues. You have to prove yourself. And once you're able to prove yourself and once you're able to pay your dues and show people, hey, I'm worth that much money, that's when you'll start making your money. So that initial investment is always going to go down in stock price until you put the effort in, until you put the time in, and then eventually you will make your own stock rise. It's not about the people around you. It's not about their mentality, their environment. Is about you. You can keep yourself challenged. If you can keep yourself mentally going, physically going, emotionally going, then you're gonna up your own stock rise. And that's what's going to make you more money in the future. That's what's going to make you more successful, is by believing in yourself and continuing to do what you believe is good for you. And eventually, it's going to pay dividend. It really will. And it's not a case of like, oh, you know, let's be all motivational and everything's going to be okay. Like, no. Life's difficult, life's hard. And something I learned in school is that it's going to be times where you don't know what you're doing, you have no idea what you're doing, and you're just kind of clinging on and going along for the ride and hoping for the best. And when that happens, that's when it's really going to challenge you. Are you able to continue after you go through that hardship? And if you can, that's when you're going to get more successful. However, it doesn't always happen, and if it doesn't, maybe then it's time for you to move on from that career or that job or that relationship or whatever it may be and try and find happiness again, because what's going to end up happening is you're going to go down that road, you're not going to be happy, you're going to get stuck, and then you're going to end up resenting yourself, everyone in your life, and everything around you and your job, and it's just not going to be a good time. With that being said, let's get back into the happy side. Let's talk about how we started to butcher animals and stuff like that. So after this quick break, you know how we do, we gotta get the anchor.fm app out there, making sure that everyone knows about it. We're gonna take this quick break, and when we get right back, we will talk about butchering animals, cleanliness, and all that good stuff. And then we will wind down with our super secret cliffhanger kind of vibe. So stay tuned to the synopsis, and we will be right back after this. So when it comes to butchering and curing and all that stuff, it's something that you learn in school, and it's very simple, but it's something that comes with practice. You can butcher a chicken and quarter it and all that good stuff, and you can learn how to do that online, don't get me twisted, but it's better to learn in school because they give you the ingredients, they give you the fresh product, they're going to give you everything that you need to really practice and really hone in your skill to make you that qualified quote-unquote chef. Now obviously when you get the culinary degree, you're going to be called a chef, you technically are a chef. But a lot of people don't deserve that title. A lot of people who skate through life or skate through school, you know, basically coattailing off of your success of what you do and your trial and error, and they just kind of come along and pick it up for the taking, basically. So when it comes to butchering, something I always would say is that if you're going to try and learn how to cut salmon or take it off the skin, culinary school is definitely a helpful thing. Salmon is hella expensive, and if you don't know how to take it off skin or butcher it, there's a lot of ways to do it. You can do it by peeling it, you can do it with plastic, you can do it with a knife. It doesn't matter your preferred method, as long as you can get it done. But school taught me many ways to do that. Like I said, my best way I do it is with a knife. I'll be able to do it and cut the skin, and if the skin sticks for some reason, I can peel it off barehanded. It's all good, make it work. I do it at my job all the time. If there's a little bit of scale on there, you can just peel it off, rinse off the salmon, good to go. Chicken, easy again to quarter a whole chicken. You can take it down on the breastbone, you can get that breast, that tenderloin, snap that leg back, take out the drumstick. Basically, when you butcher a chicken, the only thing that should be left is the bones sticking out. There shouldn't be anything else left, and if there is, you haven't done everything correctly because there's more meat to grab. Now, like I said, I do this at work because at home I don't eat the meat, obviously. But butchering chicken is very easy to do once you know how to do it. I will tell you this, if we're talking about health and safety, make sure you please wash your chicken before you start cutting into it or eating it. Do it with every single protein that you really use, honestly. Because there's a lot of genetically artificial things that go into your animals. It could be bugs that went on the carcass, stuff like that. Because remember, at the end of the day, you're eating a carcass, you're eating dead animal, you're eating dead flesh. So you're bound to get fruit flies or bugs or potentially stuff like that. When in transport, a lot of times fruit flies like to hide in cardboard boxes. That's why when you keep stuff at home or in a restaurant, you try and take it out of a box, because they can lay eggs, they can lay larvae, and that's when you're going to get all the flies and shit start to go on your food. So always make sure you rinse off your product before preparing it, before cooking it, before eating it. Anything you do with food, make sure you clean it. Goes for vegetables too. Animals love vegetables. You always hear the horror stories of worms being in apples. The reason that happens is because worms will go into apples to like have it as a home. People don't wash their fruit, don't check for it or anything like that, and then boom, there you are, halfway eating into a worm's head when you're just trying to enjoy yourself a nice red gala or something like that. So always check your produce, always wash it, always make sure it's clean, always make sure there's no discrepancies. Kind of like how you do on a prescription bottle or something like that. If the tab is messed up, you don't touch it. Same with your food. If something is wrong and you're in the restaurant, refuse it. If you're at the store and you look at it and something's wrong, send that shit back. Take it back. I don't care. Make it work, because some way or somehow it could be something really wrong with it. Could make you sick. Could even kill you. I know you're like, oh, Zach, that's an over-exaggeration. It could kill you. There has been spiders like black widows inside produce before, like I believe it was kale that it was in, and it had a bunch of eggs and people weren't paying attention. That could kill you. A black widow has a deadly venomous bite that could easily kill you. So yes, when I say it could kill you, I literally mean that. Kind of getting on to the health and safety aspect of things now. Obviously, I've gone through it a little bit in the podcast before, but making sure your raw product, like your protein, isn't with your fresh produce and all that good stuff. Making sure you always have a clean sanitizer bucket if you're in a restaurant. If you're not in a restaurant and you're cooking at home, like most people who probably are listening to this do, because this isn't a culinary podcast. This is just a subject that I was asked to talk about. Again, shout out to Tim. Asked me to talk about my experiences. But if you're at home and you're cooking, have like a little bucket with dish soap and a towel in it. So then that way you can clean off your countertops effectively and get rid of that all that bacteria that could be harboring. And that way you can keep a nice clean working area. So if you want to talk about experiences in culinary school, the most experience I had was finding out where to find all of the drugs. And I say that jokingly, but at the same time not jokingly. A lot of the time in school, especially towards the end of school, it was just a case of going in, getting high, doing something to eat, and then leaving. And that was like the last 6 months of my culinary school, honestly. Like, our industry is flooded with people who have drug problems, alcohol problems, ex-convicts, felons, whatever it may be, because it's the easiest thing to do. It's the easiest industry to get into. And it's not easy to get to the top, but it's easy to get into, if that makes sense. You can be a felon and have a dishwashing job. You can be stupid. You know what I mean? Like, you could literally fail high school or middle school and still have a dishwashing job or a prep cook job or something. If you know your basics, reading and writing, hell, even now, you don't have to know how to read and write in English. You can have it in, there's so many options now, having it in Spanish, having it in Japanese, have it in Indian, Arabic, whatever it may be. There's so many things, especially with Google Translate and all that good stuff now, that you don't have to even learn English to be able to get into this industry. And that's not a bad thing, that's fucking great. Because what that means is you learn from different people, you learn from different cultures, and that's going to help you in the long run. Use that experience to get you further. We talked a little earlier about rising your own personal stock. This is how you rise your own personal stock. You use those around you and you gain the best knowledge from them and you use it in your future. You can learn something from everybody. Even if they seem like they have no idea what they're doing or they seem like completely useless, you can learn something from that person. If you're sitting there thinking, well, Zach, how can I learn from that person if they have no idea what they're doing? Well, let's think about it for a second. Even if, let's not even talk about restaurant, let's talk about life, okay? If you're talking to, let's say, Steve, okay? Let's say Steve. And Steve is a moron. He slacks off, he doesn't do anything. He kind of reminds you of the guy from Stranger Things. Hey, let's use that Steve in this example. He scoops ice cream for a living. Steve doesn't know what he's doing. You don't think you can gain anything from him, but Steve has that courage underneath that you don't know about until you see it. Or he has that personnel person, he can talk to people. So you can take that ability of him talking to people, take that and use it in your day-to-day life. Now, if you're working in a restaurant, take Steve's ability to talk to people and use that to talk to your staff. If you're cooking from home, take that ability of being able to talk to people and use it in your descriptions on Instagram, or how you're describing your food to friends or family when you're cooking. Like, it gives you a wide variety to make something better of yourself. Now, if you're at home and you're thinking, well, Zach, I'm not going to use any of that communication or anything like that for, you know, cooking because I'm at home, then let's not take the communication expert. Let's take online or books or whatever it may be to help you, TV even. Take that information that you can gather, the best from each people. If you looked at that Nailed It, for example, that's that cake show on Netflix. It's called Nailed It. They have a cake by made by a professional. They have to try and copy the cake. All of them suck, okay? Every single one of them suck. That's the idea of the show, is that they can't bake, but they're going to try. You can take the aspects of each person, take the best feature they have in that episode, and use that to your advantage. Okay, well, they overcooked the cake, so I know if I was to make a cake, not to cook it that long. They put too much icing on. I know that I don't need to put that much on. And you can learn little things, and it's going to help you build your repertoire, build your character as a cook, as somebody who does it as a hobby or does it for a living, and you can do that. And just don't think about it with food as well. This is a whole life lesson, effectively. Think about it. You can take that best aspect of anyone and put it towards your everyday life. Oh, so-and-so is really good at handling stuff under pressure. Okay, well, when you're under pressure, now you know how to handle things because you can copy whatever so-and-so did. You know, if you're, let's say you're playing video games, okay? You're in a 4v1 situation. You're on Fortnite, for example. I don't know, that's the one I could think of. 4v1, you got to clutch it. Okay, well, I remember when Ninja did this. Okay, well, take what Ninja did. You're not going to be able to replicate it, but you can do the best you can and use the information that you got from him to try and create your own scenario in which you can win. Same with cooking. Same with playing chess, for example. People watch chess masters and they can watch them for hours and hours and hours and learn so much because you're looking from the outside in and, oh, he did that move. I could do that. Why didn't he do this? Well, you're going to see why he didn't do this because he's going to show you. Same with fishing. Like, if you're trying to catch that big bass or whatever it may be, you gotta learn that patience. It's not gonna happen in 5 minutes. It may do, I highly doubt it though. So you're gonna wait for that 20, 30, 40 minutes. You gotta learn that patience from whoever it may be. You gotta learn that calmness, that stillness. And then when it's your chance to strike, boom, you can strike, and there you go. You got yourself a big old 75-pound carp or something like that, and you can be happy about it. You can't just expect everything to be handed to you or everything to happen suddenly. You got to take your time, practice it, learn it, tweak it, make it your own, and then it will be good for you. It will be good for you, like I said, life lesson. So let's talk a little bit about life outside of school and all that stuff. Once you finish school, culinary school anyway, you know, you're in the industry already, you're doing your own thing, now you have more time to practice, you have more time to think about things. It's a good time. But then you got to think about the bills. So always think about that when you're leaving school. Think about, okay, whatever job I have, I need to put that this much, X amount of money away to pay my loans each month. And if you got a full scholarship, a full ride or whatever, hey, good for you. I wasn't that smart. I wasn't that lucky. So I have to pay bills. Put X amount away for bills. And if you don't have to pay the bills, put it in a savings account so you have it for a rainy day. You have it for the future. You're investing the money. Don't just have it and spend it, okay? The worst thing you can do is just randomly spend money because you have it. And I know you're like, oh, well, I want something nice. That's fine. You can get nice things occasionally or spend it occasionally. But don't be throwing away $200 each month on energy drinks, for example, just because you can. Okay? That $200 can be invested on the stock markets or in your bank account savings and gaining interest. And you can make more money from that. Be smart with your money and be smart with your time. The one thing I learned from culinary school is after I finished school is how much extra time I had to do things. And it wasn't a case of, oh, I have 4 extra hours in the day. It was like, no, I know what I'm doing now. I have extra time to get things done. I know how to mise en place. I know how to prep things. I know how to cook multiple things at once. So that cut down 30 minutes out of my regular day. Not hours. If it turned out 30 hours, that'd be a long day. Took about 30, 40 minutes out of my day, every single day. So now I've got 4 hours, plus that 40, plus another 40, whatever it may be. So I'm saving myself about 6 hours a day, which gives me time to do more things. It's kind of like with this podcast. The podcast takes me a couple of hours to record because I'm trying to do different things, trying to think of different subjects. And this is why we kind of ramble, because it's hard to think about things when you're just talking to yourself with a microphone in your hand. You kind of ramble, you kind of just do it. I'm literally just staring at my screen, watching the time go by as I'm talking to a microphone. There's no one to come back to me, there's no one to feed off of, it's just me and a microphone. So you have that time. So it takes a couple of hours for the podcast, like an hour to edit, then you upload it, you gotta wait for uploading and stuff like that. When I first started the podcast, the very first episode took me about 6 hours to record and edit, because I was afraid of what people would say, what people would think, would it sound good? I have to cut out every single dead air space, every single stutter. So if I was to say or say a word wrong, for example, I would cut it out, re-record it like that. I would have deleted that and said re-record it instead of re-record it. That would have been something I would have stopped, deleted, re-recorded, and then tried to edit it correctly. It took me about 6 hours for a 35 to 40 minute podcast. That's kind of crazy. That's ridiculous when you think about it. Like, why would you put that much effort in when obviously there's effort put into the podcast, there's recording and stuff like that, but people like the organic feel. People like the idea that this is just you talking into the microphone. It's genuine, it's organic, it's not rushed, it's not scripted. It's just go and let's see what happens. And that's something that I learned from school. Like, it really is. Culinary school taught me a kind of a just to let things go, let everything fall into place, and what happens, happens. Because in this industry, like I said on the last podcast, you can't please everyone all the time. It's never going to happen. But you can please some people. And those people you can please is when everything just kind of falls into place and does its own thing. And that's fantastic when that happens, because you feel good, you feel excited about it. You finally feel excited about cooking again. You can get bored of cooking very quickly. You can get bored of your job very quickly. You can get bored of the repetitive cycle of life very quickly. Trust me, I've been there, probably still there. I know, but that's not the point. The point is that when you try and please everyone else, you're not going to be able to be happy. And we went through this on another podcast about being happy and just getting your shit together. That's what it's all about. Culinary school taught me that. There was a lot of experiences that I had in that school. A lot of them were fun, a lot of them were shitty. It was kind of a mixed bag of everything. A lot of the good times, like learning how to make a creme brulee from scratch, learning how to bake a cake from scratch, make bread from scratch, sauces, all that stuff. And then you had the shitty times where you're like, okay, now we've got to sit here for 3 hours and learn the Pythagorean theory just because you need to know it for the mathematic test that is required by the state to make sure you get your degree. Well, we're not going to need to know the Pythagorean theory, but guess what? Now I know it. I forgot it, don't get me wrong, I learned it for that minute and that was it, and I forgot it almost instantly, but I had to learn it for the test. And that sucked, having to learn that stuff, because like I said, you don't need to need it, don't need to know it, but you have to for this one specific moment. And once that moment was done, so was it in my brain, it was out the window done. Certain things stuck with me, like I said, Bethavi, the mother sources, all that good stuff stuck with me, and it probably will forever. Other stuff just went out the window. So, a lot of good experiences and a lot of bad experiences as well. Bad experiences was getting stuck in the elevator once, falling down the stairs, that sucked. We had to go on like field trips and stuff. I didn't want to go, so I ended up not going. I made an excuse and said I had to work. When in reality, I don't even think I had to work that day. I think I was off. I just wanted to relax for the whole day. So I kind of said, no, I don't want to do that, because we were supposed to go to a brewery. That was another thing. Like, we learned how to make our own beer in school. That's fucking amazing. Like, I'm not really a drinker. I drink occasionally, I don't drink often, but we learned how to make our own beer. You're not going to learn that anywhere else. You're going to learn it at a brewery, obviously, but you're not going to learn that in any other school, how to make your own beer, unless you're making that hooch wine that you get out of the toilet in prison, you know what I mean? That orange is the new black kind of wine. But how to make it correctly, using the atomizer and using the temperatures outside and all that good stuff. It was amazing to learn. It was fun to learn. Can I do it now? Probably not. But there's stuff that I can do now. Like, for example, how to pickle things. I can pickle a cucumber and make it taste amazing. Make it a nice spicy cucumber. And if you want that recipe, hit me up. I'll give you my spicy cucumber recipe. Same with my jam recipe for my red peppers. I can give you guys all that information, because that's stuff I learned. And that's stuff that helped me get through my times in school. On the flip side as well, though, everything I learned also could have been learned in the industry. So like I said, ups and downs, lefts and rights. Overall, not worth the money in my personal opinion. Like I said, there was good times and there was bad times, but unfortunately for me, the tediousness, the bad times outweighed the good. You can learn your basic stuff online now. Online has done a completely different thing. You can get an online tutor now. Hell, you could, if you want, pay me. You want to pay me a couple thousand dollars to teach you how to cook? You pay me, I'll Skype you, or I'll webcam you, whatever it takes, and I'll do online tutoring for you. Simple as that. Because that's how it's evolving now. There's a lot of people who are doing stuff online because it's easier for them. They can do it at their own convenience. It makes their life a lot easier. They can do it on the go or whatever it may be. You don't need to go to a school necessarily now. I can teach you the basics online, and that's something that's killing off schools and killing off industries like that. Like, for example, the malls. A lot of malls are closing down, especially where I live right now. There's only like two malls that are actually left and thriving, but the rest are shutting down. Why? Because of Amazon, because of Google, because you can shop online now. A lot of restaurants are shutting down because of DoorDash and stuff like that. I've never once, and this was a discussion I was having with my coworker, and I know I'm off topic, but we're kind of winding down on this part. We're going to talk about some other stuff in a little bit, but we're kind of winding down with the culinary experience and school and stuff like that, because my stories are pretty dry and I don't really have a lot to talk about. But this is something I was talking to my coworker about, okay? Check it. If you go to a really good restaurant, okay, and I'm not talking about like a fast food place like McDonald's or Burger King, I'm talking like a five-star restaurant, why do they have the option to get takeout? Now, hear me out. Because not a lot of people will be like, well, Zach, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Listen, I work, I'm a chef, goddammit, I know what I'm talking about, leave me alone. Check it. I can understand you going to a fast food place and picking it up to go and eat at home. But if you're ordering like a $16, $17 salad from a high-end restaurant, you know it's going to get put in a box. You know you're going to take it home and eat it. Why don't you just go out to eat? I've never understood that, because you're paying me $18 right now, okay? $18 for me to put some lettuce in a box. Probably it will get soggy if you had protein on it or something like that. And then you're going to take it home. You can call in the order. Why don't we do that? Why don't people call up for the order? Instead of having it to go, they just come in, it's ready to go, and they can eat it. But instead, we give them a box for them to take it home. It makes it kind of shitty, because you go to a restaurant for the experience, right? There's no other restaurant, I've never been to a restaurant, I should say, that has been very nice, like a nice fine dining kind of place or somewhere you go out to eat. And I've never thought to myself, you know what would be really good right now? Us going there just to take it out and come back home. I've never thought that. It's been like, okay, if I want to go to this restaurant, I want to go there for the experience. I want to go there to enjoy the food. I want to go there to relax. If I wanted to eat a to-go order, I could go to McDonald's or Burger King or whatever it may be. Hell, I could even cook at home. So why do we go to fine dining restaurants or fancy ass restaurants like that and we get stuff to go? Wouldn't it be easier to cook at home? Wouldn't it be easier to go to a fast food place? Why spend $30 on a meal to eat it at home? If I'm spending over $30 for a meal, then I am eating it at that restaurant and I'm having somebody serve me, I'm having somebody bring me drinks, I'm relaxing, I'm taking that 20-30 minutes time, however long it takes me to eat, and I'm enjoying myself. I'm not going to myself, you know what sounds really good, me going there, spending this much money and not even eating there, just taking my food to go. Because like I said, you can do that shit anywhere. That's why we have fast food places, for that specific reason. I don't know, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm crazy, but I've never once thought that, and it's always confused me why you wouldn't just enjoy the experience. Like I said, servers are very, I'm a back of house guy, obviously. I have despised the front of house. And the reason I have despised is because servers complain about a lot of things that at the end of the day they have no idea about. They can complain about being tired. Oh, I'm sorry, dumpling, you had to work the 5-hour shift. And I've been here since 6 a.m. and it's now fucking 10 o'clock at night. I've been working 15 hours, you've worked 4, but you've made more money than me. Like, why are you complaining? And I'm not going to get into a rant about it, because I could go on for hours about servers and their stupidity, and vice versa, cooks and their stupidity towards servers and all that shit. I'm not going to get into that. But if people have serving jobs for that reason, to give the customer the experience, that's why they're there. They're not there just to bring food and to bring drinks, they're there to give you an experience. And if you have a good server, 9 times out of 10 you're going to ask for them again when you go back, or you're going to make sure that you become one of their regulars. So instead of taking out that food to go, just have that food, go sit down and have a little friendly time with your friend, with your partner, with your kids, grandma, whatever it may be, grandpa, and have a good time. Enjoy the server, enjoy the experience. Like, don't always assume that the server's going to be bad, because the fact is that this, they may be having a bad day, or they may be rushed around or whatever. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Give everyone the benefit of doubt in life. Just give them, okay, maybe they're having a bad 20 minutes. Maybe they're having a bad 30 minutes. Like, sometimes you meet people and you're like, wow, they're a dick. Maybe they're just having a bad day and they have no one to talk to. It happens, okay? But when you go out to eat, expect something to go wrong. Because if it doesn't, you'll be happy and you'll be pleasantly surprised. Now, if you go out there expecting everything's going to be perfect and something goes wrong, it's going to piss you off and it's going to ruin your day. But if you go out there and you assume something's going to go wrong and nothing does, you're going to be like, hey, you know what? That's chilling. I'm cool. It's a pessimistic look on life, I know. But if you expect the worst and the worst doesn't happen, hey, you're doing good, right? So that's my talk on the culinary aspect, a little bit of stories from school, a little bit of what about I learned, all that good stuff. So what we're going to do is, since we are winding down on the podcast, I'm going to talk about one more topic. And this topic is going to lead us into our next podcast, and you will find out what that is in this next segment right after this. December 1st, 1948, the Tamim Shud case. For those who don't know, the Tamim Shud case is also known as the Somerton Man. And this is a case about a man who was found in Adelaide in Australia. And basically, nobody knows who he was, nobody knows who he is still, and his death is a complete mystery. So, if you look up the Somerton Man, you will see a picture of him. I know nobody's going to know who he is, because it's been close to 80 years now, no one's still talking about him, nobody still knows who he is. So, let's talk a little bit about the Tamim Shud case, aka the Somerton case. December 1948, the very 1st of December, 6:30 a.m, the police were called after the body of a man was discovered on Somerton Beach. It's about 7 miles away from Adelaide, okay? Just so you can have an idea. He was lying back of his head, resting against the seawall, his legs extended, feet crossed, and it's believed he was to die while he was in his sleep. Now, this was later disputed after they found some orange thread, which we'll discuss in a little bit. But right now, we're going to talk about the rest of the stuff that was found on him. An unlit cigarette was on his coat, okay? He had a unused second class rail ticket, also in his jacket, a bus ticket, and an American comb, a half empty packet of gum, and another cigarette, a cigarette package that contained 7 cigarettes and some matches. So both the bus ticket and the rail ticket were never used, okay? So this is what people were like, this is weird. A lot of people had seen this man the night before, but assumed he was just a guy resting or sleeping. A couple said that they saw him extend his arm, then his arm went numb, or limp, as they said. So people just assumed it was a guy either drunk or intoxicated, under the influence, and just kind of let him and be ignored. Now, on his body, on his personnel, was a piece of paper, a note, that had Tamim Shud, which is translation to mean ended or finished. So a lot of people assumed that this was a spy, or a lot of conspiracies came out about this, because this was right around the time of World War II, the Cold War, all that shit. So a lot of people actually suspected this as Somerton Man was a spy, and it became more suspect that he may have been a spy when nobody came forth to claim the body, because it was posted worldwide. The police followed up with a lead meeting a girl called Jasmine. Now, they showed Jasmine this man's face, and apparently, to police records, her face went pale and blank like a ghost's, okay? But yet she still denied knowing who this man was, or even meeting him. She said she gave the copy of a book which had the Tamim Shud page, and it was a book that was like ripped out or something like that. And she gave the book to a man who they went to see, and he still had a copy of the book, but it wasn't the same dude, obviously, because this guy had died. So they still don't know who the Somerset Man is. It was shown in the autopsy that before the man died, he had eaten a pasty, which for my American viewers is like a pastry dish like with savory food like a sausage or meat or something like that before his death. That's what he ate. Now, the scientist who conducted the autopsy believed that it wasn't a natural death, that there was use of barbiturate, yes, let's go for that, or a soluble hypnotic. So barbiturate is a drug that acts as a central nervous system depressant, which can be used for sedation to death. It can be used for hypnotics, anxiolytics, anticonvulsions. It's used a lot in the medical industry to help state people, etc, etc. He believes that this could be used to kill this man. So a lot of people believe that it was a death, that was suspicious, that it was a spy and all that good stuff. But we fast forward to January 14th, 1949, the Adelaide Railway Station. A brown suitcase with its label had been removed, checked into the cloakroom at 11 a.m. on the 30th of November, 1948. Okay, so this is like 2 months beforehand that it was checked in. It's a day before the Somerton Man was found. And a key thing is that the suitcase had the label missing. Now, the Somerton Man also had all of his clothes, tags missing, no identification on him. So it's basically like somebody was just trying to get rid of him, acknowledge his existence completely, just erase it from history and time, which they've successfully done, ironically, because nobody knows who this man still is, and it's been 80 years nearly. They believe the suitcase belonged to the man, the Somerton Man, who was found, and there was a red checkered dressing gown, size 7 pair of slippers, 4 pairs of undies, some jammies, shaving items, brown trousers, and an electrician's screwdriver, a table knife, and a pair of scissors were all in this suitcase. Very weird mixture of items, which again led people to believe the idea that this man was a spy and that he was either a traitor or he was founded. And they killed him, they got rid of all the evidence, so basically the government wouldn't claim him as their own. And we're not talking US government, it may be Australian government or stuff like that. So there was a orange thread of Barber brand wax, which was unusual because it wasn't available in Australia. It's kind of thread that you would use to repair your pants. It's not like a fishing line thread or anything like that. It's like a thread that you could use to repair your pants with. That was the only thing that linked this suitcase to the Somerton Man's body, was because this thread was also found on the Somerton Man. Identification marks on the clothes had been removed, but police found the name T. Keen on a tie, Keen on a laundry bag, and Keen without the last spelling of a letter E, and another piece of laundry which had dry cleaning marks which had multiple codes on them. So all of these things found in the suitcase, there was 3 pieces of dry cleaning that had a code on them that people wasn't able to crack. A lot of people looked at this code, a lot of people tried to figure it out, no one could actually figure it out. So, on the records, the man was on the railway station, they speculated he had just showered, shaved, all that good stuff, but he never got onto the train, he never got onto the bus, he never did any of that stuff. So this guy was just randomly there, and they still don't know what happened. And I know it kind of seems like this is just all over the place, but this story is all over the place. People speculated that he was based on uranium mines, and that he may have been a member of ASIO, which is the Australian Security Intelligence Organization. A lot of things involving spies and all that good stuff. Again, this story is all over the place because it really is all over the place. Like, people didn't know about the Somerton Man. People didn't know who he was. People didn't know where he came from. People didn't know his name. People were just linking things together, and they didn't really have any evidence. And you got to remember, this is back in 1949, okay? So we didn't have CCTV footage back then. They didn't have the technology they have now. It was just, okay, we found 2 pieces of orange thread which aren't available in Australia, which is suspicious, so we're going to link them together. For all we know, it couldn't have even been the same person. It could be something completely different. But this is what led to all the spy cases and all that stuff. But this man is unidentified. It's been 80 years, and they still don't know who he is. Now, with that being said, the Somerton Man is still trying to be discovered as his identity or whatever he was. There was a lot of cases between 1945 and 1949 that could be related to the Somerton Man. There was one regarding Joseph Marshall, the Magnuson family, and there was one more, which was the Magawas. Now, the Magawas, the monks, and there was all kind of potentially related to the Summerton Man. But again, the Summerton Man has still not been found to who he is. And you can look online, like I said, and you can see this man's face. And to know that somebody successfully erased this man from history, effectively, is crazy to me to think about. Because this man is unidentified. And this is what our topic of next week's podcast is going to be. And it's not going to be as all over the place as a Summerton Man is, because a Summerton Man is all over the place. You could go down this rabbit hole. And I did. I only went down the rabbit hole a little bit with you on this podcast. But next podcast, we're going to go really down the rabbit hole, because there are a lot of cases like this. Missing bodies, missing people, missing identities that no one knows about still. And it's unbelievable that it's been 70, 80, 90 years and people still don't know about these bodies, about these people's names, their faces, anything like that. And they could all be potentially related as well. There's three or four that could be related. We could really go down this rabbit hole, and we could go dark and deep and as far as possible. So, on the next episode of Synopsis, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to go into unidentified people, mystery cases, murder cases that have this kind of Summerton Man vibe, where people don't know who the victim was, but they want to find out. That's on next episodes of the Synopsis. So winding down here, we're going to go back to this time online. One last thing we're going to talk about with the online, because as of right now, recording August 5th, it's going to be uploaded August 5th as well, so, you know, it's going to be the same thing. There has been thousands of people evacuated over an explosion in the military warehouse in Russia. We want to make sure that all those people are safe in Russia, so hopefully they are. It looks like a bunch of fireworks went off. It was kind of crazy. Today is National Underwear Day, and it is also National Chocolate Chip Cookie Day. So grab yourself a cookie, enjoy it. Ideally, the Lenny and Larry's one, the vegan ones, just saying, they're really, really good. Also trending on Twitter today, video games are not to blame. We'll go back to the start of our podcast where we were talking about the whole Daytona and El Paso shootings. Video games aren't to blame. We know they're not. People are killers because they are, at the end of the day, terrorists, and it's as simple as that. I don't care if you're white, black, Asian, Muslim, it doesn't matter. If you are killing multiple people like that, you are a terrorist. You cannot switch that in the media. Simple as that. You are terrorizing life as we know it. Therefore, terrorist. I think that's something we can all agree on, is that if it's affecting life like that, it's terrorism. Simple as that. You don't have to be from a different country. You can be from the same country as you're attacking. You're still a terrorist. With that being said, this time online, we're rounding it up. Next episode of the Synopsis, we're going to be talking more about the Summerton Man. The story's not going to be all over the place, but it is going to be interluded with multiple stories about missing people, unidentified people, and things of that nature. It's going to be a crimey kind of vibe next episode. Again, thank you so much, guys, for listening to the Synopsis. Thank you for helping. Thank you for pledging. Thank you for supporting the show, supporting myself, because at the end of the day, you guys are supporting me. Whatever you do is supporting me, supporting my family, and we appreciate it very much. We hope we're bringing you good content. We hope you enjoy our content. I hope you like what I'm talking about. I hope you will continue to listen. You'll share with your friends. You'll share with your family. You'll share with whoever you want. And this isn't me begging for likes, shares, and all that stuff like a YouTuber or anything like that. But if you genuinely enjoy the podcast, share it with your friends. Show them. Have them have a listen, because the more people that listen, the more interactive the show will get, and the more things I'll be able to do on the Synopsis. So I really do hope you can share it with friends and family, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. Share it. Just let me know what people think. And then hopefully I can do like mailbags or something like that, where I answer questions, Q&As, all that good stuff. And hopefully we can get this into a really fun, interactive podcast, and you guys will be here along for the ride with me. Again, thank you for your support. Thank you for the love. Thank you for listening to the Synopsis. Episode 13 coming out hopefully on Wednesday. I have been Zach. Thank you for joining me down the rabbit hole, and we will hear you all next time.